Those sounds are from the Görlitzer Bahnhof subway stop, named after a historic train station that, like so many in Berlin, wore its geography in its name. The trains from the Görlitzer Bahnhof headed toward Görlitz, a small city in Saxony a couple hundred kilometers away, ferrying people and coal, and because this is Germany, also pickles. Lots and lots of pickles. I always loved seeing how these small towns are name-checked in the capital's greatest landmarks, the Brandenburg Gate, the Prenzlauer Berg, and many more. Because it reminds me of the deep line running right through the soul of Berlin. It's not the wall, it's the culture. Berlin is a world city, a diverse and humming center of global creativity and commerce, but it is also a provincial place, pinned down like Gulliver by history and geography, by a dozen little rail lines, to all of these ailing small towns throughout the former East Germany. Görlitz is not just a regional pickle hub and a drop-dead gorgeous film shoot location, it is also a town whose bright young people abandon it as soon as they can, a wary and listless place that had a far-right mayoral candidate with a big lead late in the campaign recently. I know towns like that because I lived in one of them, in Eastern Germany, as a teenager. And I lived in Berlin proper after that. As an outsider, it can make your head spin, this chasm between the free-spirited corners of Berlin and the other one, the wary, walled-off one. As an outsider, I found lifelong friends in small-town Eastern Germany, even as a kid with a Jewish-sounding name at the start of the neo-Nazi revival of the 1990s. As an outsider, though, particularly if you've got darker skin than mine, you can be made to feel just how unwelcome you really are there. That conflict in the life of any foreigner in Germany has been with me for decades, and it's why, when I read a self-published excerpt from writer Musa Okwanga's new work, In the End, It Was All About Love, it went straight into my veins. He did that thing that writers can do for us all, putting down some truth that feels like it's about your own life, even if you didn't have the words for it. That's why I'm starting these next 5 episodes in Berlin with Musa, a poet and podcaster, a cake eater and Moscow mule drinker, a relatively recent transplant to Berlin who speaks so clearly already about this place. These episodes were recorded, of course, in the before COVID times, but the summer is almost over, COVID is not going anywhere, and I think this show is ready for some of the evergreen glow of these cities, Berlin first and then Havana, Cuba, that will be there for us all when this is all over. These new episodes will be coming out every other Monday. And in a particularly sweet coda, we are also going to be releasing previously paywalled archive episodes, 45 in all, from London to Erbil to Nairobi to beautiful, beautiful Beirut. They will be coming out in this feed every Thursday, free for everyone for the very first time. I'm also happy to update you that since we talked for this episode, Musa found a publisher for his book, and you'll be able to pre-order it from Rough Trade Books starting in November. Oh, and that immigrant-bashing far-right mayoral candidate who was leading the polls in Görlitz? The Greens and the Socialists and the Christian Democrats all threw their weight behind a single candidate to take him down. Their guy, a Romanian immigrant named Octavian Ursu, won and is now the proud and capable new mayor of Görlitz, Germany. There is hope everywhere. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you are listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. Now here's Musa with me talking about those Moscow mules.
We're going slightly blind here because there's no depth perception given me. That is a good, generous, well, I think it's a good, I think it's a good beginning. Let's go up to the bottom of the handle, the vodka. There we go.
There'll be more.
There'll be more. Okay. And then, I think start.
Yeah.
That's actually very generous. That's good, that's good.
Will we make it? Well, we're professionals. This is a professional activity.
I'm a pro, I'm a poet. Several years vintage.
I'm a pro, I'm a poet.
Yeah.
That is the...
We've seen...
Excellent bartending.
There we go. Listen to that crack. That is an extremely pleasing sound. Let me just pop these in.
Yeah.
These to taste. Squeeze a bit.
You got it?
Not a bad start, okay?
No. So, cheers.
Cheers, thank you.
Thanks for coming.
These aren't bad.
Hey!
These aren't bad, actually.
You're a pro.
You know what it is?
You're
it's
a poet.
It's putting at the level.
First man in Moscow, Mueller, I just thought, I'm never going to get into that. And here we are.
And now it's on your fucking rider for podcast appearances. Yeah. You're like, if we're going to drink, let's do a Moscow Mule.
It's funny. It had to be that. It had to be the Mule.
So why Moscow Mule?
Because it's an old style drink. If you go to other countries, if you go to London and ask for a Moscow Mule, they'll look at you and be like, that's an old drink. Like, it's a drink they haven't really drunk regularly since the 70s or something. And I associate it with my first few months in Berlin where I was dating a lovely woman, Angela. Shout out to Angela if you're listening.
Hey, Angela.
And we go to these bars and this was like the favorite drink there. And it was also 5-6 euros and you just kind of get into it really fast. It's a traditional Berlin drink, yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, you'd figure, I don't know, I for someone who loves vodka, let's be honest, and also had lived in Russia, I had no idea what the provenance of Moscow Mule is.
I have no idea the origin. It's crazy because I should know. It's actually quite irresponsible. I didn't check it up, but no idea.
Here we are. We were professionals when we were pouring the drink. The research part, I guess, yes. Is kind of left us aside. Well, we should start with how I met you. A day and a half ago through a beautiful thing that you posted on Instagram, which is, you know, like, fuck social media, but sometimes it's like, it just delivers you these strange gifts sometimes that you would never have gotten otherwise. So what was it? Why did you post it? And then we'll talk about it.
Sure. So I wrote this 30,000 word novella called In the End, It Was All About Love, based on my first 4 years in Berlin. So it's, I would say about 90% factual, 10% fictional. There's an element of magic realism in it, which comes in about a third of the way in. And I wrote this and we've been trying to get it published, but there's always been a challenge. It's like, oh, is this prose? Is this poetry? Is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? I was just like, it's writing. It's about the city. And I wrote it with such a visceral form. I woke up every morning at 6 a.m. and then just wrote while it was still dark until the light came up. And I didn't write, you know, like when you're working out, you don't work out until you're exhausted, you work out until everything's tingling. So I'd write until I was tingling and then I'd stop. So that means that the book is written with this real intensity and rawness, and it's all pretty much sort of first take, like that's all pretty much undrafted.
It's the colostrum. It's that, let's call it colostrum. It's that first, this is probably a foul metaphor, but it's that first squeeze of milk from a cow or any mammal, you know, that's like the richest in the cream, right?
That's the idea. That was the idea. It was like the distilled form. And I would think about what I was going to write the day before that night, and I'd wake up the next morning, just write straight away. Black coffee by the set on the left hand, bottle of water on the right. And off I go. And I wrote this and I basically just went on Instagram and thought, let's put it out there and see what the people think. And so I posted the opening chapter, which you read, which is I think the first sort of six screens, like six screens on Instagram.
Yeah.
And you read it. And it's funny because the reaction from Berliners, those who've been there for a year and those who've been there for 30 years, was the same. They were like, this is our city.
It's so weird. I mean, there's so many amazing lines in the novella that you had sent me. And thank you for this kind of advanced copy of the full novella. But that was a thought that just kept recurring to me. It's like, oh yes, I know that. Like, I, you know, the perfect time to eat cake is 2 p.m.
Yes,
just like these, you know, these strange. I just had never thought about it that way, but like. Yeah, of course. These are ways, or the way that you kind of, and I love your writing style behind it, which just seems really consonant with the production, the thing that you actually wrote is like, you're almost kind of not weaponizing, but making advantage of the things that suck most about Berlin. The fact that it's fucking dark at 6, yeah. And it's going to be dark, you know, yeah. I mean, it's a real dark and it's, you know, short days and you're saying, okay, well, I'm going to carve a space out of a short winter day.
Of course.
And write.
And that's the thing. I think, and also think the book, it tries to walk with you through a city. So, I mean, I write it in this of the second person. It's almost like a kind of like, it's in this sort of role player games like Halo or Grand Theft Auto. When you're walking through and it's like you're seeing it in front. And I was like, I know that it's my story, but I want it to begin by being your story. So I want you to imagine you get off the plane or the train and you walk out and this is the first city that you see, the first part that you see. So yeah, maybe that's why it it connected with people. Maybe that's why.
I mean, and as I was saying when we came in here, I think people really responded well to it on Instagram because it's really fucking good.
Well, thank you.
I mean, sometimes you don't have to overthink it.
No, no. Well, maybe, yeah. Hopefully. Thank you.
And then the gatekeepers will follow, the publishers. Well,
it's funny. I had two messages from publishers after that going, what are you doing with this? And I actually had a meeting with someone last night who basically said, look, if they don't put it out, I will, which is really lovely. So we'll see. And I said, look, like, we'll see who likes it. And I really... I'm so grateful for your interest. And he had this whole plan. He said the nicest thing. He said, you sent it to me after he wrote to me on Instagram. You sent me the full novella, which is 129 pages. And he said, I got my bath with the pages printed out and read it. And I read it all in the bath. And the water was cold when I got out. And I just thought that to me was, that was everything for me.
That's, wow. Well, I feel bad. I'd feel like I didn't earn the pages. I was in comfort when I read it.
I don't advise anybody to sort of get pneumonia.
Yeah, right.
My account, yeah.
But you're right about the format. I mean, obviously, this is a problem with being a writer and trying to be a commercial being,
yeah.
Is that people want easily graspable concepts, formats, something that markets well. You start with poetry, you go into prose.
Yeah.
You talk about your career as a musician. There's not a track added to it, but it's multimodal, I guess.
Yeah.
But tell me about that poem at the beginning, which itself is a lovely thing and an interesting kind of opener to the novella. It's kind of personifying of the winds.
Yes. Yes. So there's an amazing artist from Austria called Maria Bichler. Maria got in touch with me, and she's wonderful. Shout out to Maria if you're listening, and I'll send this to you. Anyway,
right.
If you don't.
Hey, Maria. Hey, Angela.
Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah, so Maria's great, and did an exhibition with her. She did an exhibition of found objects in Berlin. She contacted me saying, I really like your work. Can I work with you, collaborate? And she said, look, I found all these objects in like flea markets that experience or express what Berlin is. Would you like to write a poem to accompany these found objects? I thought to myself, how about if my found object is the wind itself? What happened to the wind that, and this is the poem's concept really, so like, what happened to the wind that basically sent slave ships across the waters? What if it was really happy to do that job? What if it was like, yeah, great, like let's, can't wait to sell off these Africans, let's do it. And it was like, well, what if wind has a character? So what if wind is progressive, if it's conservative? So you've got wind that basically, it's been in the lungs of civil rights activists in the 60s, and now that wind has come to Berlin and it warms, it cools the bodies of queer people after they've made love one afternoon. It hovers over barbecues to chill them on a hot day. And it's almost like everything in our environment, because I believe in the psychogeography of Berlin. I believe this city has so much depth of emotion sunk within it, even within its stones, that if I could express that lyrically or poetically, then it would be a great start for the book.
Also drawing a parallel and kind of being able to situate yourself as a British person with African roots in the German problem, which is Berlin is not an African city in the sense that, like, I'm sure they would have loved to be as some horrible version of Belgium back in the day, but they weren't, you know, they weren't at the heart of the slave trade. All of their horrors, you know, were sort of located in different places. I just thought it was interesting because, you know, as I'm half Jewish and I have lived in Berlin, I've never been able to look at that history really in the face because it's...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's very fucked up and it's hard to metabolize the love for my friends who are hosting me in this place and all the people I've known and lived with here and then all the horrible things that happened. But the poem was interesting, an interesting place to start because it kind of... By using the wind, you're sort of able to put yourself into, I mean, you talked about the anti-fascist, you know, standoff on a windy day across, yep, Spandau or something, you know, yep, like,
of course.
It's like really interesting to kind of combine and tie those things together.
And I was there at the anti-fascist standoff in Spandau. So these are all experiences I've had. So one of the poems, one of the later poems talks about black gravity, the concept of there being parts of the city where the psychogeography is so heavy and the trauma is so great that black people actually experience spontaneous physical injury. So that speaks again partly to the Jewish experience where there's some parts of Berlin that is so overwhelming, you can't physically metabolize it.
Yeah.
So let's say that something very terrible happened at a certain place, for example, where the Berlin Conference happened in 1884. So the poem that I write later on in the book basically talks about a black person going to the site of the Berlin Conference where Africa was carved up and having to wear a heavy jacket to protect him because the atmospheric pressure there of racism is so heavy, it would have broken his bones.
Well, there's your rebuttal to, that's right. They did have the conference where they decided to carve that corpse.
But unlike Germany, it's invisible. So we don't experience that visceral. We don't see, you know, you have the Stolpersteine here. You have the stones where you can see, the brass stones where you can see where Jewish people were removed from their houses. So you see that visually. And I'm not sure how I would experience that as a black person if it was that blatant. I think it would be a very different city, I think, if I saw that much.
Well, it's a weird thing because Berlin is a place where you are having a lovely, you know, autumnal walk, and then you see a little plaque, and this is where they threw Rosa Luxemburg's body in the river, you know.
Right.
And these moments kind of have a way of popping up. And, I am 1,000% for the German sense of remember this shit, which I feel like our friends in many parts of the world, including the United States, could take a lot of cues from. But it's different now because we were talking while we were making Moscow Mules about that Moscow-leaning district called Marzahn, which is, all kind of a Soviet-style Brezhnev housing that has gone bad, you know, and is now a rough neighborhood that even I, as a sort of odd, you know, sort of accented white person, would feel strange going to, and for black Berliners has felt like an off-limit zone. I mean, is that part of the psychogeography of the city for you, feeling like there are safe places and unsafe places?
Absolutely. Even today when you invited me to Pankow, I had to check the map and be like, am I going to go there? You know, it was, or what part am I going to go to? And I checked and I was like, it was fine. But there's parts of Berlin like Weißensee where you're not quite sure you're going to go, depending on what part you go to. Hohenschönhausen, there's actually a bar here, and I won't name its name because I'm getting in trouble, but there's a bar here which takes its naming from Adolf Hitler. And the only reason it's still there is because its door number is the same number. So they basically named the bar after I'll just name it. It's called Zapfan 88. And that's the street number. So every time people go, oh my gosh, it's a Nazi bar, they're like, no, it's just the door number. But that bar is a bar that people know about.
Yeah, I see these fuckers on the internet with their 88s.
You see, and also one thing I start doing, if I go to certain parts of the city, I start looking for the symbols of neo-Nazi clothing because their own clothing brands, their styles, it's very subtle. So if you know what to look out for, you know who is wearing neo-Nazi clothing, even though it's not like the swastika, it's something different now. It's a sports brand, it's a fashion lifestyle thing.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
How do you, I mean, you've been here 4 years, you're a professional at this now, but you do write about, in the novella, you write about, you know, being accosted essentially by smug, spitting racists of, you know, various sorts who I assume would just kind of blend in. Like you don't see them from a mile away, these two women who just start barking at you and
yeah.
Took your phone. And, you know, I mean, like, how do you not get paranoid?
That's a great question. I think for me, the turning point was going to the anti-fascist march in Spandau in 2017. Because I think it was just after Charlottesville, just after the activists had been killed in Charlottesville, rest in peace. And I thought, what would my heroes do at a time like this? They wouldn't just sit and write opinion pieces or go and do interviews on the radio like I was doing. They'd actually get out there and they'd march. So I thought my heroes are going marching, so would I. So I got on the train in Zoologischer Garten and met a friend of mine. Shout out to Sasha, if he's listening.
What's up, Sasha?
What's up, Sasha? and I got on the train from Zoologischer Garten to Spandau with him, another person to come with me. And I remember acutely just sitting on the train facing that direction. It's weird. When you get on the train to one of these marches, it's the only real time the neo-Nazis can see you because there's no police presence on the train. It's only when you get there. So until you get there, actually, it's an open season. They could meet Antifa, and it's a bit of a tense moment. It's a 40-minute journey from Zoologische Garten to Spandau. And I remember sitting on the train, and I was opposite my friend, and he was looking up every so often to see who got on the train in case it was, you know, one of them. And I never looked up once because I wasn't afraid. And I was like, my back is exposed to whoever comes on this train, and I'm not scared. And that was the turning point. After then, I'm like, you couldn't scare me at that point, because it was the moment when it was the day when I reclaimed the city and said, yes, it's your city. Yes, you live in that part of town and you hate me and you hate the fact that I'm black, you think I'm inhuman. Okay, you know what? You believe that. It's also my city. And I was out with another friend another time, and he said, look, there's a neo-Nazi bar around the corner from where we are. So he took out his pepper spray. He goes, look, I've got pepper spray in case anything happens. And I looked at him, I looked at myself, and I thought, you know, it's a bit dark and maybe we should protect ourselves. And he was like, you know, I'm protecting myself with this pepper spray. And I thought, I've got nothing like that. Then I said, why should we be afraid of them before we see them? Fear's a transaction. What if they're afraid of us? Like, and he was like, what if we run into them? I said, well, what if they run into us? Like, it's not, I'm not saying we should go out looking for trouble, I said to him, but let's not be afraid before we have the confrontation. And that shift in attitude is why I'm still here, because I don't approach situations from a position of fear anymore.
It's astonishing. I mean, that sense of, well, I mean, I guess that's how you deal with any ground level reptile, is imagine their own fear first.
And also because there's an intelligence. The far right often get perceived or described as lacking a level of cunning. It's not so much that, it's more like a kind of certain, you know, to use the cliche, it's like sharks with blood in the water. There's an acute sense they have for fear. They can definitely smell fear, and it sounds like victim blaming. It's not victim blaming. It's more like they induce this state of fear through extreme acts of violence every now and again. And it's perfectly natural to be afraid of them. If you can find a way to minimize the fear that you manifest whenever possible, it helps you navigate difficult situations. And it's not saying you should seek out trouble. It's just saying that I've tried to find ways to minimize the fear that I feel.
I mean, it almost feels of a part with going back to the way that you metabolize the things that are worst about this city, maybe the extreme dark in which you found a good place to write.
Yeah.
You are going out and doing some very German shit, like eating cake at 2 p.m.,
exactly.
You know, and having a nice poppy seed marzipan or something, you know, like these little things that you have shown that you're kind of making your own space, right? You're kind of spreading your shoulders in this city. One of the things I thought that was really interesting was the way you talk about surprising visitors to the city. You know, I guess you had a cousin who visited.
That's right, yeah.
And you took her all the way out to the west.
Yes.
To where the forests and the lakes are. And you said, you know, they come looking for drum and bass. I give them bird song. that to me is such a beautiful thing. And it's also a way of saying it, like you're not constricting yourself or confining yourself into these very diverse several neighborhoods at the heart of the city. You're really going to jog this place.
Absolutely. And then that's how you sort of take ownership. And I think the beauty of Berlin, its enduring quality is that it's bottomless. And it's the quality of all great cities. Sao Paulo, Shanghai, these places, you know, they're just, you can lose yourself. I mean, Sao Paulo is the one city I've been terrified of, not because of any kind of crime or violence, but just the sheer scale.
Yeah.
It's the one city I've been to that actually felt out of control, like I didn't know what it was doing, whereas most cities feel like they know what they're doing. But yeah, certainly with Berlin, I always celebrate the diversity, the richness of the geography itself, the lakes, the hills, the forests, within the city's boundaries. You know, it's unbelievable.
It is, but it feels to me always, particularly because you have the state of Brandenburg and you have the rural parts like Mecklenburg, where I lived as a teenager, where you have small towns, and increasingly those are unfriendly zones for, you know, foreigners in general. I just always have this idea that, you know, when you start to see the trees, it's like when things get a little odd. And like,
do you know, like we go to a horror movie and the beginning of the movie is really still. Some cities you arrive in this country, you arrive there and there's that kind of sort of preternatural stillness. Having said that, there's a place I went to for a friend's wedding called Treuenbrietzen, where I went to, and it's got, you know, quite a high vote, conservative vote. But there was a guy living there, a Ugandan guy who'd been adopted by a family. He was 8 years, he'd been there for 8 years now and absolutely loved it. And so earlier in the week, they've been tearing down AFD posters before our arrival, just so we don't feel, you know, too uncomfortable. But then he's been living there and having a great time. What you realize is fear of the other, it's so projected. It just sits in these small towns, this fear of the other, and it's not rooted in anything tangible. It's just, there's something out there we're afraid of. When you actually meet someone like this guy there, that's the loveliest guy, and he said, I love it here. And he was dark-skinned as me, and I just thought, it's so funny because these people are voting for the most nihilistic parties, but on a daily basis, they're absolutely friendly to this guy here. He might say, oh, well, but he's black, oh, but he's different. He's like, he speaks German. He, you know, it's bizarre.
Well, and that's a way also of understanding less of the monolith of, I guess, the racist far right, and that it's complicated for them in a sort of oddly human way.
Yes.
I remember being, you know, my name is a tough one in German because Nathan, there's a famous book that's called Nathan the Wise, which everybody, you know, it's like an unread masterpiece. You know, everybody gets assigned it in high school and they don't like to read it, but they know it's about a Jew. So Nathan is like the most Jewish name, which is not true in the States, but in Germany, it's like Nathan is like,
wow.
So I remember being in a neighborhood like Matan up in Mecklenburg and Schwerin and, you know, just super drunk and out partying, and these neo-Nazis come and over here, they kind of accost us and they're like, what's your name? And I tell them my name. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh fuck, you know, like this is getting strange. We started to, you know, kind of our friends and their friends started to draw. And, you know, my friend is like, yeah, you know, this guy's, yeah, he's a foreigner. He's from America. And all of a sudden, Jens Ritter, I still remember him, the head neo-Nazi in town, this hulking bowling ball of a dude, just immediately melted. And he was like, America, my brother loves baseball. Can you tell me what a slider is?
Oh my goodness.
Or something. It just turned into this whole other like conversation. They were so excited. And the Jew fell away and the American, you know,
sliders with Nazis
emerged. And I, you know, and we ended up continuing the party, I think, together as a,
it's like a Larry David sketch. Yeah. But it's, isn't it painful because it shows how close, I mean, it's an amazing story, but it also is, it's tantalizing, isn't it? In terms of, look how close we are to a better world, like communication, yeah, and like, right, people. If only there was a way to tell people or show people who are so afraid and so angry that the focus of their anger and their fear wasn't a valid focus. But that's the story of our civilization, isn't it?
But what an amazing thing for you in your part to sort of, to do your part to walk without fear, to not assume the worst of the worst people.
That has a value. Sometimes you get, yeah, on a train just for the sake of it and just go into an area where you might not be welcome. And you don't do it to seek out trouble. You do it because if I want to go there, I'm going to go there. And that has a power in it. It's almost like I'm not trying to impose myself on a space. I'm just trying to navigate a space and just be present. And actually, this is a great story. A very good friend of mine. I won't name him because he probably wouldn't want it. But we're really good friends, and we've become very good friends over the last couple of years. He took me to one side one day and he said, Musa, like 20 years ago, like I used to be part of the Nazi youth groups, and we used to chase people who looked a bit different, well, you know, foreigners, and we used to chase them through the streets. We used to beat them up, like me and a couple of my mates. And he said, like, what do you think? And I said, well, look at the evening you've organized. There's like 15 of us here. You've pulled together a group of like diverse people, all different backgrounds, ages. You've organized that. You've organized one of the best weekends I've had in my time here. You did that. 20 years ago, yeah, you were chasing people like me through the street, but look at the person you really are. That speaks to who you are. And he gives me so much strength and courage because I know that he is fighting those battles still. I know that he goes back to those areas where he grew up and he sticks up people like me when I'm not in the room. And that means a lot. That means a lot.
What happened to him? He just grew up.
It's not even that. He's just a nice guy who got exposed. You know, he said, I'm not making excuses for it. He never made excuses for it. He said, all I would say is that the youth culture back then was the dominant youth culture in terms of being a Nazi. When the wall came down, the West was this kind of force that was imposing itself all of a sudden job security went. So the Westerners that came over with this kind of position of this economic superiority, cultural superiority, look at these like these Berliners who are ignorant. So the Nazi movement was a way of like, this is people who fought off communists. So they were like the, a lot of the Nazis sort of harnessed that sense of, we're the anti-establishment, we're the anti-authoritarian. The Nazis were the cool kids. It was very easy to flip that for the neo-Nazis to kind of say, look, the West are this kind of like alien incursion. We're going to beat them out. Any manifestation of the West was beaten out. And my friend was part of that. You know, he to some extent embraced that. And now he rejects it, but he says, you know, I'm not making excuses. Just it was the sense of we are sticking up for those who weren't stuck up for when the wall came down.
I guess you can ride the waves of kind of history in one direction or the other.
Well, they weaponized it. Yeah, they weaponized it.
Yeah.
Because not everyone did that. The Antifa were clued up and they were like, no, this is not the way. But the problem with the Antifa, the problem for them was there were just so many fewer of them because it's so hard to be that nuanced when you're on this tide of pure emotion, nationalism, identity. And the left were kind of going, well, actually, they're both systems of authoritarianism and what you're doing is replacing one the other, but they didn't want to hear it because the teenagers, they're like wiling out.
Right. I did appreciate that as much as, and certainly my family back in the States could never understand me coming here and being in a place where, I don't know, some people like broke into my house and painted a swastika on my door and, you know, it's just neo-Nazi shit going down.
That happened here.
Yeah, not in Berlin, up in Mecklenburg. And, you know, what I always told them was, did you know every Saturday night, anti-fascists go with like bats to the main square of the small city we live in and they fight Nazis? And I was like, you know, yes, there are definitely Nazis, but they're anti-Nazis. And just the politics here, like, you know, it was the most real and vivid and felt to me really viscerally strong version of like progressives that I'd ever seen.
I think the reason Germans are like that, I always think whenever I see incredible anti-fascists here, the incredible organizers, the activists, I think, what was in your own family that was so bad? Why are you so good at this? Not in a kind of critical way, but sort of simply saying, you look at those families that grew up after the war and there was that knowledge. You're looking around as a child, you're thinking, wait a minute, all these plaques, all these Jews dragged out, they lived in our building. You're thinking, Mum, Dad, like, what were you doing? Imagine that first conversation where you're like, the Jewish family that lived up there, why didn't you help them? Like, what did you do to stop them? And you suddenly realize that actually there's a whole town full of people, right, towns full of people that didn't. When the tide was turning, they turned the other way. And there were a lot of very enthusiastic Nazis and some who just fell in. But ultimately, the indictment of that society, and that conversation is still ongoing, which is why I think that the anti-fascist movement here is so visceral and so powerful. And so because I've got friends who still don't talk to half their families.
Yeah.
Because half their families are like still Nazis and not neo-Nazis, actually Nazis who, there's no neo, there's no kind of derivative. These are actual Nazis.
These are like OG.
Yeah. Hitler, real OGs.
Hitler, Indiana Jones.
Hitler
Nazis.
Was right. Didn't finish the job. Like all that lot, that crowd.
They do exist. Tell me how you got, and you engaged this question a few times in the novella, but why did you come to Berlin?
A variety of things. One key prompt was a conversation I had with a friend of mine, an architect in Brazil. I was there during the World Cup, so I cover football as well. So I was covering football for a couple of different organizations. Shout out to my editor, Tony Karen, Max Strasser, my editors.
Back Tony? Back,
yeah, Tony Karen, the big man.
My old comrade in arms.
Hey, that's a great man. So I was doing some work out there at the World Cup and a friend of mine, we were having dinner together and he said, look, why are you still in the UK? You're so international in your outlook. Why not Berlin? And I was like, Berlin, I'm not sure about. And then I suddenly thought, wait, I did German 20 years ago for my A-level. Like, this is a language that I have.
Why did you do German?
Because this was the foresight of it. I thought, German's a really hard European language. Of all the languages, you've got Italian, French. My French is pretty good. I thought, I can pick up Italian and Spanish through French. German's the outlier of those main ones. If I do that now, my brain is still pretty supple. I can pick it up again later. So that was the kind of the foresight of like, get German now.
The nubile young brain of Musa taken on the language of Goethe. But you went into law after Rilke. That.
Absolutely. The plan was maybe at one point to do law with maybe EU law, European lawyer. So in a different life, I'm an EU competition lawyer in The Hague, which is a great living and a great job. But I'm happy doing this.
Yeah, you don't get to drink Moscow Mules as part of your
competition. Not at 4 p.m., no.
No, that is true. But, you do have this kind of... I mean, obviously, you just kind of, you succeed wherever you go. But someone who has studied law at Oxford and decided to then create music and art and poetry and writing, yeah. Why does Berlin fit into that? I mean, how does it fit in with your creative work and the fact that this is the journey that you're taking?
It may be in many ways the perfect atmosphere for me to create work, me specifically, because for all the challenges with the far right, one thing I think I do say in the novella is that Berlin is a city of extremes. So for the negatives, the positives are astonishing. I've met the best people here, the very best people I've ever met anywhere. Within 2 years of being here, I was... marrying, I was basically conducting the wedding ceremony for Sasha and Bortru, two of my best friends here now. They were like, we want you to do it. And these are popular people. They know a lot of people. They were like, we want you to do the ceremony. So when you come to Berlin, when people embrace you, they take you to their very hearts. So we have the kind of the community, which is essential for any artist, but also Berlin has this astonishing stillness. It has a change of pace unlike anywhere. So a friend of mine came in and he said, Musa, my goodness, where is everyone? You hear about Berlin being this rave city, where is everyone? And I was like, be careful what you wish for. Because if you want Berlin to change pace, go to nightclub at 12:30 and then you'll see it. The next half hour, you'll see it. 12:30 to 1 a.m., you'll be begging for it to slow down again. And I love that because Berlin starts so early and goes on so late that you never miss a night out. You never miss a great experience. So for a writer, it's perfect. You can walk its long streets and contemplate, and then you can just disappear into it that night.
Would you feel differently if you came and had not studied German, did not speak German or take it on?
Yes, because I made a deliberate choice when I got here, not to go to expat societies, but to come here and engage with the city on its own terms. So I didn't seek out fellow English speakers. I went to the nightclubs by myself. I had one rule when I was socializing. I was like, when you come here, don't be desperate to meet new people. Turn up to a night, poetry night, hip-hop night, whatever. Have a good time, have a dance, nod, whatever, and then head off. And then what happens is, of course, after like two or three times you go, some people are like, oh, who's that guy? Like, they invite you over. Come to this. And because you don't impose yourself in that way, you're just doing your thing, people respond to you, they gravitate towards you. And I did that, and that was, I think, the key to making such good friends here. I didn't kind of force myself into the space.
I think that a lot of the conversations I'm going to have here, if they're anything like the 10,000 conversations I've had in Berlin in past years, will have some element of nostalgia, slight regret at the pace of change. The best Berlin is always hovering somewhere between 5 and 25 years in the past. Do you feel that sense? You sound remarkably kind of sanguine about not just Berlin, but Berlin right now.
Yeah, I think because as a black man, frankly, I mean, for me to romanticize Berlin of the 1990s would be difficult. But I think, there are major challenges with Berlin, primarily gentrification, of which I'm a part, of course, just moving here, although I'm not structurally responsible for it. I benefit from it. I don't believe the best Berlin has gone. I think that you have to believe the best is ahead. I think that's important. Because what's that great phrase that your words determine your reality? And the way you talk about a city, if you're constantly nostalgic and reaching back and saying that was better then, a lot of that stuff was better. But fundamentally, what was better was the prices. I mean, capitalism is basically swallowing up parts of the city, but that's not the people's fault. The people didn't lose any soul. The people didn't lose that. The city failed them, or the capitalist system failed them, but the spirit of Berlin is still there. If you say to me, oh my goodness, Berlin hasn't got the real people, well, I'll give you a list of 25 people that would disprove that. I'll put 25 people in a room from Berlin against any city in the world, and you'll be like, wow, like, that's an incredible place. To assemble that variety of incredible people from that city, it must have something special, and I could do that anywhere. Like, that's no problem for me.
Yeah, and it is true that very often, no matter where you are, you're sort of telling on yourself when you're like, this place isn't fun anymore.
Because also, I always think, people say that to me, I'm like, what are you bringing to the table? It's like when you're at university, people go, oh, I went to such and such university. I'm like, yeah, but what did you do there? Like, what did you get up to? You had student societies? Were you do some activism? Did you run a magazine? Did you throw some cool parties? Like, what did you do there? Don't just turn up and be like, don't, I remember when I was at university and someone goes, oh my goodness, I heard the vibe at this club is really amazing. I was like, you're standing with a cocktail glass in the middle of a dance floor. The vibe you're talking about, you're standing in it. Like, you know, so it's almost, people come here and they like, they want to be entertained. But to me, it's like, you got to give. Berlin's like a cookout. Bring a dish, you know?
Amazing.
Bring a dish.
And if you want the Berlin of the salons or the squat culture or, you know, kind of punk bands in a burnt out shell of a building, like, well, go and create some of that. Get yourself out there.
Oh, my friend, shout out to Jumi. Jumi set up one of the best poetry nights I've ever been to. I did the best gig of my life in this place. It's called a Poetry Meets Soul series, Poetry Meets Hip Hop. This is like this amazing place. It's Via Neukölln in Hermannstrasse. You go down there. So every 2 months on a Saturday night, if you don't get there at 8 p.m., which is the start, you won't get in. 250 people got in the night I was there. 200 got turned back.
Wow.
So I now get there an hour early. I get there at 7 with my glass of whatever, probably Moscow Mule. Because I love soaking up the energy because you go, it starts, the night starts at sort of 7:30, goes until 1 a.m. And you see your entire infrastructure, ecosystem of Berlin in there. The entire sort of social ecosystem is there. And I just think, well, Jumi created that. She was a black woman who grew up in Aachen, I think Nigerian heritage, who basically was like, I'm going to go and create culture or a place for it. And that the best Berliners do that all the time.
Shout out Jumi.
Shout out to Jumi.
All right, let's get a refresher on this Moscow Mule. And then I got to talk food and football with you.
Can't wait. So
and
close.
Of course, I am the kind of asshole who, looking at vodkas and duty-free, saw the Japanese one and I was like, okay, Japanese vodka.
Did you get it because it was different?
Yeah.
I love getting stuff that's different. I always try that. If I go to a bar and see a beer on tap that I haven't had, I always get that one.
Tell me about food and drink here then, because right. It's funny. It's an unexpected and frequent guest in your novella.
Right.
Is the food moment.
Yeah, that's right.
Something. So tell me why that speaks to you when you have to talk about your life in the city or the city itself, why food gets in there.
Food is a ritual for me, right? So I talk about cake. There's a chapter on how to eat cake in Berlin. And it talks about all the times I've gone to get food for a particular mood or moment. So got cake on a couple of dates that were really amazing that could have gone somewhere further, but for other reasons they didn't.
Further with the cake or with the date?
Well, the cake always goes down well. the dates were lovely, and I sometimes go to those places because it reminds me of beautiful times I had with that person.
And then even when you got broken up with, not to, you know,
of course,
get a tangent, you then, you know, there's a radioactive, you know, kind of shield around that restaurant, right?
Right. There's a restaurant I went to where I had a really bad breakup and I couldn't go back. It was my favorite restaurant in Berlin. I couldn't go back in there for 18 months and I've barely been back in there since. So I think it's still a bit radioactive.
But generally the geography of eating out in Berlin has been friendly to you. There's good moments. There's things that you want to tap back into and can't
wonderful
get
moments. Yeah. There's an amazing Nigerian restaurant called Ebe Ano down in Charlottenburg, which is just a place that feels like a kind of home. Not that I'm Nigerian, my heritage, Ugandan heritage, but just to be around sort of fellow Africans in sort of undiluted, unapologetic form. I was going to eat there with a friend of mine, Steffi. Steffi runs a great bookstop called Intercontinental down by Oskreutz. Shout out Steffi.
And hey, Carla. Steffi.
And I was going to book a table and she says, Musa, like, she said, Musa, if you try to book a table there, they'll laugh at you. It's a Nigerian restaurant. You turn up, you eat.
Steffi had to break down.
She had to bring Africa to me, but she was right. So yeah, I mean, for me, food is a kind of ritual. It's a way to reward myself because as a writer, I work so long in isolation. Going out for a meal, the sense of occasion is so important, so powerful. And also, there's a diversity you get from the city. There's Sudanese food, Lebanese, Syrian. Of course, there's great German and Austrian food. You've got the schnitzels here. So it's really a way to engage with the city. Oh, also, the Italian spots are great too.
But let me talk about a nostalgia.
Yeah.
I've had some of the worst Chinese food in my life in Berlin, and that was a long time ago.
Right, right.
It feels like that this is one thing that Berlin is actually doing. You know, we don't want to like throw London on it, but it's moving.
It is moving.
Yeah, and you can have these amazing food and people will sort of recognize it.
There's a challenge in Berlin in that, well, there's a couple of challenges. The first is the city is not as diverse as London. And so then the cuisine tends to be tailored towards a dominant palate, and the German palate doesn't really go for spices in the biggest way. So actually you'll get better food in Hamburg, I think, on the whole, because Hamburg is closer to the water. It's got the port. So you have that diversity. You want great Portuguese food in Germany, Hamburg's your place.
Yeah.
Greek food too. Vietnamese. Well, Vietnamese food's pretty good here because they've got the East and they've got all that. But if you really want great food in Germany, it's easy to find in Hamburg. But if you dig a bit in Berlin, that's the thing with Berlin. The thing about the food in Berlin is, like so much of the rest of the city, you have to work a little bit harder than you would in a lot of other places. But then the effort is so worth it when you crack it.
Yeah. And again, you're building those muscles, the way that you have to earn the summer by getting through the winter.
Yes, absolutely. And I love the sense of joy when you've discovered something. And the other day, a friend of mine got in touch, Shante, fantastic writer over here from London, Shante J, got in touch, and she was
shout
like,
out Shante.
Shout out Shante, absolutely. And she was like, oh, where's a good fish place? And I was like, you know what? Check out Fischfilet up by Eberswalderstrasse. That's the one. Get on the M10 tram. Couple of stops down, near Husemannstrasse, and it's the stop. And she was like, oh my goodness. She sent me a picture. She's like, this is just absolutely delicious. And this is a Londoner, you know.
Big standards.
Absolutely. So yeah.
you had a chapter about, brief chapter, but it was really moving for me, about schnitzel.
Yes.
Just what an odd sauceless thing they do here.
Yes.
What's the highlight and low light of the German menu for you?
The schnitzel could be the highlight and the low light. And I mean that with respect and love, simply because the schnitzel is, it's an entity unto itself. I mean, it's the size of a turkey dish. It's huge. I mean, you know, it's the size of a laptop cover. It's huge. And they serve up with that sauce. Now, if you like that, if you're in the mood for schnitzel, I mean, I normally have them with a bit of mushroom sauce, in which case it's the best thing. But if you have no sauce with it at all, which is what the Austrians and Germans like, then it's a disaster. You might as well be drinking sand. It's just so, there's no relief from it. It's an attritional dish, and it's almost like a trial of strength to complete it. And you feel like when you finished it, you're like, oh, you've passed some kind of test. That may actually be the German citizenship test.
That's the new one.
To complete it, yeah.
Forget, you know, these racists who are asking you if you speak German.
Can you eat a schnitzel?
Yes.
Yeah. That should be the contest, yeah. Without sauce, yeah.
Because in Marzahn, we eat our schnitzel without sauce.
They probably do.
You had just come to hear from recording your own podcast, Stadio, which is a football podcast, soccer as we call it back home. Mm. You and I have both worked with Tony Caron,
the great man,
who combines a deep love of the beautiful game with politics that are somewhat left of Stalin, and it's just an incredible combination. It's one of my favorite comrades on earth. How did you come to football writing, football presenting, and what has that done for you here in Germany?
Well, it's been amazing, first of all, for me in Germany. It's been incredible experience, and I came to it, I mean, I suppose my family's always been involved in football. My grandfather coached Uganda national side for a few years back before the war.
Goodness, okay.
Yeah, way back when, sort of 60s, he coached them. Was an amazing coach, and a couple of my cousins ended up playing All-America, third team selected, soccer and uni. And actually it's funny how sport runs in the family, one of their daughters, Le Caribert, now plays golf for Alabama, the University of Alabama, and finished second in like the PGA, like the amateur PGA like tournament.
You guys are just athletes.
Well, some of them are.
I mean, poet athletes.
Exactly.
You still play, right? You've got a team, the Unicorns.
They're amazing. I stopped playing for them 2.5 years ago.
Oh, no.
But no, it's great. We won a knockout tournament. On my Instagram, you can find the picture of me with the trophy. We won a tournament this summer. An invitational tournament, 7-a-side, which I was playing in.
You got the band back together.
We did indeed. I got called back into action, like the Avengers. Yeah, exactly. Sam Jackson. So football's always been in my family and in my blood. And so it was 2007, I was asked, look, I was approached by a literary agent who said, look, I've read some of your stuff, want to work with you on something. He said, I'd love to write a book about football. And that was the first book I wrote, A Culture Left Foot, which got nominated Sports Book of the Year. And it was really just looking at what makes for a great footballer, but where is greatness in football? So not just about what makes a great footballer, but what is it we love about this strange game? Why are we so obsessed with it? And really just over the years, my sort of career has taken me in various directions. But being in Germany, I find that football is such a kind of fast track to the soul of the nation. It's a shortcut to so many great conversations because I have this background in it. It bridges a kind of cultural gap that might otherwise be there. So yeah, it's been wonderful.
How is Hertha doing?
Good, good. So they've just got Jurgen Klinsmann in and...
Oh my.
Yeah, there was a bit of a concern because
stolen back from America.
Didn't do the best job, actually, I have to say, in the US. But
yes, you think?
But Hertha playing some really enterprising stuff. And maybe there's something to be said for, if you're in the right context, you know, you're a better coach, because I think what Klinsmann has done is he's breathed life into a kind of slightly moribund uniform. Hertha is a club which has underachieved given its fan base, very passionate fan base, large, loyal crowd. 55,000 people every game, that's a lot of fans. So I feel like they're almost due a kind of shot in the arm, and I think Klinsmann's given them that.
Yeah.
Really exciting.
You went to Brazil.
Yeah.
How do we get to, it's Qatar, right?
I mean, that's extraordinary.
Are you going to go?
No.
Why not?
I mean, I'll be watching the games, I'm sure, because everyone's going to watch the World Cup. Everyone would watch the World Cup. I mean, people watched the World Cup in 1978 when Argentina were basically throwing people out of helicopters during the tournament. And, you know, people did all of that. I think I'll watch it or observe it or comment on it. But I think that going there, it provides a level of like normalization, validation that the tournament could never, it doesn't deserve.
Yeah.
And even I'm not sure how I'm going to cover the tournament yet. I'm not sure what I'm going to do in order to critique it, because obviously, by talking about it, you normalize it. By watching the games, getting excited, you normalize it. There's no question. So how do I navigate that space? But the Qatar World Cup is...
It's incredible. I mean, I was in Berlin. I was in Brazil also during the World Cup. And you had the feeling, you know, despite Brazil's personal problems as a side in the tournament, you know, you just had the feeling that, like, there is probably no better... It just, how could it be better?
Put it this way. Somebody said to me when I got back, how was the World Cup? And I said, imagine if someone said to you, you're going to spend a month in Brazil for the World Cup. Imagine that. And I said, and he went quiet. I said, it was better than that. I cannot name a single, in terms of 30 continuous days I spent anywhere in the world that were better. I'd be very hard pressed to name a better 30 days in a row than 2014 World Cup. It was astonishing, to the point where when I went for a walk the night before I was due to fly out. I flew out 2 days after the World Cup, so the airports wouldn't be so busy. And I was sad. I couldn't stay at home then. I had to go out and walk. And I walked down to Ipanema.
Yeah.
And I went to a local restaurant and it got sort of on the barbecue places. And I was just sitting by myself and feeling sad, but I had to be among people. A bit like the Hemingway, Clean Well Lighted Place, that short story. And these two lovely women were like, oh, we're traveling. Oh, they were having trouble cutting a piece of meat, so I helped them cut it. And they were like, do you want to sit with us? I was like, oh yeah, sure, sure. So I sat with them for the last thing, we just chatted, and I just thought, I needed that closure because this is so beautiful. This was like kind of breaking up. Leaving Brazil after the World Cup was like leaving a partner. Let's say you both meet on holiday and they live in New Zealand, and you've got like a family business in Scotland, and you're never going to like, it's never going to work. So you have to kind of, you know, you have to part. And it felt like that, like parting was like a holiday romance. It was that beautiful.
Yeah. I guess I also am having a difficult time imagining that kind of wistful airport scene in Doha, leaving the Qatar.
No, it's not going to happen.
But, well, I'm sorry that I wasn't there to be at that table that last night in Brazil with you. It just feels like, wherever in the world, I would enjoy having a drink and sharing a meal with you.
Oh,
that it's here in Berlin on the heels of the Instagram pre-publishing of this amazing novella, which I am so glad is going to find a home now.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, we're still in discussions, but I hope it works out. Really hope it does.
I have a list just to give the listener a sense that, you know, I wasn't in a cold, you know, a cold bath or anything. I was just as a very comfortable human reading through it, but just like picking words. So the way that I do with some, you know, there's some writers, Kevin Barry is one I've been reading recently, where I have to get some of the sentences that he wrote just down on my own fucking sheet, you know? And I felt that way with this novella of just like plucking phrases and sentences, because it's so beautiful. It's so personal. And I only hope that our conversation does it a bit of justice, but whenever the fuck it's published, I would urge everybody to just go and buy it, because it's a really beautiful thing. I didn't expect to find it. And here it is, and here you are. Thank you.
You're an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Theme music by Dan the Automator. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Special thanks to Andrea and Ron Benschneider, my beloved hosts in the leafy and progressive parts of Panko, and to Martin Engelmann, my Greek chorus, and to Reiner Engelmann, my first and forever best roommate in Berlin and beyond. Alexa Van Sickle provided B-roll sound for this episode and was very good, as usual, to drink beers with in Berlin. Next Berlin episode is with the chef Billy Wagner in 2 weeks. The very next episode on this feed, though, is from the archives, as we start re-releasing our previously paywalled episodes for the first time, free for everyone. If you were a Luminary subscriber, these episodes will be familiar, but hopefully still worth a listen. The next one is a fun one in which I get half-cocked on cheap vodka with Oliver Bullough, chronicler of London's greatest financial crimes. That will be out on Thursday, August 27th, right here in the same feed you're listening to this on. We will meet you there.